A lot can happen in a week. Some of it good, some of it bad, some of it downright ugly. When faced with intriguing developments in the week's news, we turn to a rotating panel of non-experts to parse the good, the bad, and the ugly of it all. On today's panel, UH Downtown Professor of Political Science David Branham, Houston Chronicle News columnist Joy Sewing, and Raul Ramos, Associate Professor of History at the University of Houston. David, Joy, Raul, welcome to Houston Matters.
Hello, Craig. Hi, Craig.
Thank you, Craig.
Panel, a University of Houston study suggests air quality in Houston and other large cities across America could improve quite a bit if everybody, and I mean everybody, switched to electric vehicles. Study co-author Dr. Ali Mousavinejad says in order to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, improve air quality, and create a sustainable mass transportation ecosystem, it would cost billions in public works investment into the development of charging stations, upgrading the power grid, manufacturing EVs, and building new public transit systems. But as Houston Public Media's Tom Perumian reported this week, the study finds if all that were to happen, 157 premature deaths could be prevented in Houston each month, and it could result in hundreds of millions of dollars in daily health care cost savings. Of course, the study doesn't offer specific remedies to realities that may limit such a transition, like how it's cost prohibitive for many of us, how industries here that our economy relies on could be hurt by it, or just good old-fashioned political opposition. Still, want air quality and health outcomes from it to improve in Houston? All we have to do is switch every last Houstonian to electric cars. No problem, right? Right? But is it good, bad, or ugly? David Branham, start us off.
Oh, I get to start. Okay. I've been reading the study, and I'll be honest, I think this is kind of a pie-in-the-sky thing, and I do have some questions on the calculations that were in the study. Not that I'm saying that anybody was doing anything to actually try to misguide someone. I would just look at it and go, well, this is a little bit crazy. One thing I saw right off. Los Angeles, if you had full electric vehicles in Los Angeles, they said that would actually cost more lives in Los Angeles because the solids in the air would actually increase. And as a result of that increase, more people would actually die sooner. And the other thing they say about Houston specifically here is that cars are maybe our least biggest problem when it comes to pollution, with our oil industries, petrochemical industries, the Port of Houston putting solids into the air. They basically say that it will have a small effect in Houston if they were to do it and go fully electric. The other issues would be so problematic that we would still continue to have people dying. And the thing I think about is, you know, wouldn't it be easier or less costly to just move people out of the city and get out of these bad air areas, which we have. And, you know, you see them every day. You know, I live on the northeast side of town. My son goes to Texas A&M Galveston. When I drive over, it's nothing but petrochemical and smoke in the air, and it's just really bad on the east side of town. And they say that blows right into the northwest side of town in the study. Yeah, I think we need to make adjustments. Constantly make adjustments over time, basically do this in an incremental process, because otherwise it's just going to be way too costly to make such a big change all at once. I think everybody wants better air, and I think we should make moves to make better air, but we have to be sensible about it.
All right. Good, bad, or ugly. Joy Sewing.
I think I agree with you, David. It's kind of interesting, and I'm glad you read the study. I just kind of did a cursory look at it. I don't think it's a pie in the sky. To say that everybody in Houston will be driving electric cars is delusional thinking. We can't even figure out how to stop illegal dumping. You know, we live in a city with no zoning, and there's a fight for property rights and all this stuff. So I just don't see this happening. I would love to have some kind of remedy for having clean air as an allergy sufferer myself, but I don't think this is it.
Okay, good, bad, or ugly, Raul Ramos.
Well, I'm going to say that the study itself is bringing up some good information, and that is to put the research part on one side and then put the prescriptive part on another. In other words, what to do about it, I think, is a longer question that's not really in the range of what these researchers specialize in, let's say. They're there to quantify. And what I think it quantifies is something that we consensus, but really don't have a way of putting our finger on, which is we can talk about the cost of change, but there is a cost of keeping things the way they are. And that's the part we don't often acknowledge, because we look at the cost at the pump as the only cost that matters, when the cost in terms of healthcare, in terms of lives, in terms of traffic, in terms of infrastructure, all of these costs are constantly borne out onto the lives and pocketbooks of all Houstonians. And so I think in terms of raising the question of hidden costs, of unquantified costs, this study has done, an important work that we need to keep looking at because we can't turn away from that. We can't ignore it. I think it also brings up another point when we do talk about the remedy and this question of change and how much change costs. I think this brings up a paradox in Texas. On the one hand, we have some of the fastest growing renewable production in the country, if not the world. The amount of wind power and solar power that's being generated in our state is incredible. And how fast that's happened is a testament to the low barriers of entry to entry, particularly regulatory barriers to entry that have existed. And we're benefiting from that. The last freeze we had, we didn't have the same kind of outcome that we had in the previous disaster because of renewables and batteries and all these other options and possibilities. On the other hand, the paradox is that our political system allows for lobbying and for those entrenched economic and political forces to maintain the status quo, to keep things where we are. And they're willing to spend more money on that than on any kind of change. And so that's the tension in our state right now. Talk of any kind of change in terms of our transportation infrastructure, in terms of our power infrastructure, is not just a question of how much it might cost. It's who's benefiting from that.
I think you're right about that. But I would also suggest that what's going on in politics isn't necessarily what's going on in corporate America. I think that our power companies have shown that they know that they need to change, that they know they need to evolve over time, and that it's coming, but they just don't want to be crushed in the process. And so I think that probably is a lot of the lobbying going on. But with the study, I mean, it's you're talking about a massive change all at once. I don't want to drive an electric car. Not now. I might in the future, but I don't right now. Maybe a hybrid.
You don't want a Tesla?
I don't want a Tesla that's going to run out of battery juice, or, you know, that loses its charge in the middle of the freeway. Now you just get off, get gas, and you're right back on. You're right. You're okay. So I think there's a lot of convenience that's going to be lost that needs to be adjusted for. And the other problem that I see worldwide is that if you look at population projections, the biggest problem is going to be how are we going to generate power for the world for a population that's so much larger than what we have right now.
So no one said good, bad, or ugly. So we're looking at complex. Is that the word?
That's good.
Okay.
Thank you, Joy. You added that perfect word to the show.
We can go with complex. Okay. It's fine. Panel, phone calls last Friday and follow-ups from Houston ISD mistakenly informed some families that their students had to attend summer school or be held back a year. Turns out the district was using a list of families it says were, quote, initially required to send their kids to summer school, and that some campuses may not have updated the list with the district's central office. As of early last month, some 26,000 students were required to enroll. That's about 14% of all students in the district. But as the Houston Chronicle's Nusaiba Mizan reported Tuesday, that number may have decreased after final grades and attendance appeals. It's not clear how many families were called by mistake. To add further confusion, some parents report their calls didn't specify which students in the family would have to attend. Still others say the message left no callback number. HISD tells some district families their students have to attend summer school or be held back. And while that's true for some who were called, it's not for others. Oops. Is this good, bad, or ugly, Joy?
Absolutely bad. And I think it just adds another layer to what the saga of HISD at this point with the TEA takeover and the superintendent in charge, who has been very vocal in how he runs the district. You know, I think you're bound to have some type of mistake like this. I was one. I didn't get the call because I've blocked the numbers because I was getting so many calls from HISD, probably 4 to 5 a day. So I got a letter saying that my child would be going to summer school. And when I contacted the school, they said, well, it's not required. And although she made good grades, they were giving this as an option. And I just didn't understand, because it was usually when you go to summer school, you are failing something or you want the extra help. So, I think this is just another one of those things that is plaguing the district. There's so many issues that, the Chronicle has written about that parents like me and others are experiencing, and we're tired and exhausted by it all.
Raul.
I think I'm on that same phone call list.
Did you block them?
Well, it's amazing because I remember this was a complaint. I don't know. I'll call it the old HISD or whatever. It's always been a question, how often to call, when to call, when to communicate, how to communicate. At the core of this is a question of communication and the importance of communication, particularly in education.
Yeah.
Go back to this idea of it's complex, right? HISD is one of the largest school districts in the country, right? Not just Texas. It's a big machine. There are going to be problems. But these problems are only made worse by a particular system that's been put in place. It's very unidirectional, top down. There's very little, going back to communication, there's very little communication. Well, there's no incentive to communicate from bottom up. Feedback is only accepted if it matches the narrative that's being brought down. The news story reported that schools were not updating the list for the district. And so somehow they passed the buck down to the schools. But again, this isn't bound to happen when the second problem is you have a particular structure that essentially is meant to be top down, where the schools, the administrators, the teachers, and the students themselves are like widgets. They're just to be acted on versus to be engaged. I don't think this was unexpected. This was the main issue in Dallas when Miles was superintendent there. You brought someone in who was running schools, but I think it's something like 8 schools. I mean, compared to the size of HISD and the complexity of the district, this kind of system that was working in these charter schools isn't going to scale up to a district that's as diverse, distinct, and really requires a kind of two-way communication that has been there. Maybe not perfect, but certainly you just don't scrap it and expect things to work right.
All right, David?
Well, I'm the one here who doesn't have children in Houston ISD. So my kids are now in college. So I'll look at it from the outside looking in. To me, it looks initially, just the phone call itself, looks like a fairly minor mistake, something that can happen in a big organization. But I've talked about Mike Miles before on this program, and I've criticized his leadership. I think he has a problem with his relationships with his employees. You know, when you talk about his previous experience, it's not been on that scale where, you actually have to have people who are willing to follow you, not only just follow you, in order to really be successful in an organization that big, a school district that big, you need to have people who are willing to take a bullet for you if they need to. That's the kind of leadership you need. He was put in a position, in all honesty, where that was almost impossible. You know, where he was not a popular person to be in the position to start with. And I don't think he's done things to make it better. That's my criticism. He hasn't developed relationships with teachers. He hasn't shown respect for his good teachers. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's a really big problem.
Absolutely.
He hasn't shown really have respect for his staff that are really good staff, because the entire district isn't made up of bad teachers and bad staff. Yes, I understand changes need to be made if you're going to do this, but you need to develop that following. You need to develop that allegiance where those people who can really make the change for you see you as a person who is willing to do whatever it takes to do that, and that your motives are, we want to make the best school district in the country. Our kids are what matters. And I don't think he's established that. And that's the biggest problem here.
I think if this had happened in the previous administration, we would have chalked it up to a mistake. And that's what it was. It would have been just a mistake. But on top of a year of so much change, of this adversarial relationship, of a dictatorship in many ways of how the district is run, then you end the school year with something like this. It's like putting salt on a wound that many parents have had opened all year.
Raul Ramos is an associate professor of history at the University of Houston. Joyce Sewing is a news columnist with the Houston Chronicle. And David Branham is a professor of political science at UH Downtown. Raul, Joy, David, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Craig.
Thank you, Craig.